Welcome to Words to Live By, a podcast series hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Each week, we'll share some of the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. In essence, words to live by, made up of radio addresses and speeches he delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s.
Who could have imagined, perhaps a year ago, that 2020 would bring in an era of a global pandemic that shut down our economy, brought unemployment to record high numbers, and changed the way we interacted with one another? As our country reopens and we attempt to bring back some level of normalcy, we're reminded that when Ronald Reagan took the oath of office as America's 40th president on January 20th, 1981, the country was experiencing some of the bleakest economic times since the Depression. Taxes were high, unemployment was high, interest rates were high, and the national spirit was low. Bringing America back was the new president's top priority. In fact, during his 1981 inaugural address, he said, "This administration's objective will be a healthy, vigorous, growing economy that provides equal opportunities for all Americans, with no barriers born of bigotry or discrimination. All must share in the productive work of this new beginning, and all must share in the bounty of a revived economy." Almost as soon as the inaugural ceremony was over, President Reagan set his sights on Capitol Hill. From day one, he and his team worked tirelessly to get Congress to pass legislation to put the economy back on track. Even a near-fatal assassination attempt did not slow him down.
4 months into his presidency, he delivered remarks on the Program for Economic Recovery before a joint session of the Congress.
Let's listen.
"You wouldn't want to talk me into an encore, would you? Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, distinguished members of the Congress, honored guests and fellow citizens, I have no words to express my appreciation for that greeting. I have come to speak to you tonight about our economic recovery program and why I believe it's essential that the Congress approve this package, which I believe will lift the crushing burden of inflation off of our citizens and restore the vitality to our economy and our industrial machine. First, however, and due to events of the past few weeks, will you permit me to digress for a moment from the all-important subject of why we must bring government spending under control and reduce tax rates? I'd like to say a few words directly to all of you and to those who are watching and listening tonight, because this is the only way I know to express to all of you on behalf of Nancy and myself our appreciation for your messages, your flowers, and most of all, your prayers, not only for me, but for those others who fell beside me. The warmth of your words, the expression of friendship, and yes, love, meant more to us than you can ever know. You have given us a memory that we'll treasure forever. And you've provided an answer to those few voices that were raised saying that what happened was evidence that ours is a sick society. The society we heard from is made up of millions of compassionate Americans and their children from college age to kindergarten. As a matter of fact, as evidence of that, I have a letter with me. The letter came from Peter Sweeney. He's in the second grade in the Riverside School in Rockville Center. And he said, "I hope you get well quick, or you might have to make a speech in your pajamas." He added a postscript. "P.S., if you have to make a speech in your pajamas, I warned you." Well, sick societies don't produce men like the two who recently returned from outer space. Sick societies don't produce young men like Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy, who placed his body placed his body between mine and the man with the gun simply because he felt that's what his duty called for him to do. Sick societies don't produce dedicated police officers like Tom Delahanty. Or able and devoted public servants like Jim Brady. Sick societies don't make people like us so proud to be Americans and so very proud of our fellow citizens. Now, let's talk about getting spending and inflation under control and cutting your tax rates. Mr. Speaker and Senator Baker, I want to thank you for your cooperation in helping to arrange this joint session of the Congress. I won't be speaking to you very long tonight, but I asked for this meeting because the urgency of our joint mission has not changed. Thanks to some very fine people, my health is much improved. I'd like to be able to say that with regard to the health of the economy. It's been half a year since the election that charged all of us in this government with the task of restoring our economy. And where have we come in these 6 months? Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, has continued at a double-digit rate. Mortgage interest rates have averaged almost 15% for these 6 months, preventing families across America from buying homes. There are still almost 8 million unemployed. The average worker's hourly earnings, after adjusting for inflation, are lower today than they were 6 months ago, and there have been over 6,000 business failures. 6 months is long enough. The American people now want us to act, and not in half measures. They demand, and they've earned, a full and comprehensive effort to clean up our economic mess. Because of the extent of our economy's sickness, we know that the cure will not come quickly, and that even with our package, progress will come in inches and feet, not in miles. But to fail to act will delay even longer and more painfully the cure which must come. And that cure begins with the federal budget. And the budgetary actions taken by the Congress over the next few days will determine how we respond to the message of last November 4th. That message was very simple. Our government is too big and it spends too much. In the last few months, you and I have enjoyed a relationship based on extraordinary cooperation. Because of this cooperation, we've come a long distance in less than 3 months. I want to thank the leadership of the Congress for helping in setting a fair timetable for consideration of our recommendations. And committee chairmen on both sides of the aisle have called prompt and thorough hearings. We have also communicated in a spirit of candor, openness, and mutual respect. Tonight, as our decision day nears, and as the House of Representatives weighs its alternatives, I wish to address you in that same spirit. The Senate Budget Committee, under the leadership of Pete Domenici, has just today voted out a budget resolution supported by Democrats and Republicans alike that is, in all major respects, consistent with the program that we have proposed. We look forward to favorable action on the Senate floor. But an equally crucial test involves the House of Representatives. The House will soon be choosing between two different versions or measures to deal with the economy. One is the measure offered by the House Budget Committee. The other is a bipartisan measure, a substitute introduced by Congressman Phil Gramm of Texas and Del Latta of Ohio. On behalf of the administration, let me say that we embrace and fully support that bipartisan substitute. It will achieve all the essential aims of controlling government spending, reducing the tax burden, building a national defense second to none, and stimulating economic growth and creating millions of new jobs. At the same time, however, I must state our opposition to the measure offered by the House Budget Committee. It may appear that we have two alternatives. In reality, however, there are no more alternatives left. The committee measure, quite simply, falls far too short of the essential actions that we must take. For example, in the next 3 years, the committee measure projects spending $141 billion more than does the bipartisan substitute. It regrettably cuts over $14 billion in essential defense spending, funding required to restore America's national security. It adheres to the failed policy of trying to balance the budget on the taxpayers' back. It would increase tax payments by over a third, adding up to a staggering $250 billion. Federal taxes would increase 12% each year. Taxpayers would be paying a larger share of their income to government in 1984 than they do at present. In short, that measure reflects an echo of the past rather than a benchmark for the future. High taxes and excess spending growth created our present economic mess. More of the same will not cure the hardship, anxiety, and discouragement it has imposed on the American people. Let us cut through the fog for a moment. The answer to a government that's too big is to stop feeding its growth. Government spending has been growing faster than the economy itself. The massive national debt which we accumulated is the result of the government's high spending diet. Well, it's time to change the diet and to change it in the right way. I know the tax portion of our package is of concern to some of you, but let me make a few points that I feel have been overlooked. First of all, it should be looked at as an integral part of the entire package, not something separate and apart from the budget reductions, the regulatory relief, and the monetary restraints. Probably the most common misconception is that we're proposing to reduce government revenues to less than what the government has been receiving. This is not true. Actually, the discussion has to do with how much of a tax increase should be imposed on the taxpayer in 1982. Now, I know that over the recess, in some informal polling, some of your constituents have been asked which they'd rather have, a balanced budget or a tax cut. And with the common sense that characterizes the people of this country, the answer, of course, has been a balanced budget. But may I suggest, with no inference that there was wrong intent on the part of those who asked the question was inappropriate to the situation. Our choice is not between a balanced budget and a tax cut. Properly asked, the question is, do you want a great big raise in your taxes this coming year, or at the worst, a very little increase with the prospect of tax reduction and a balanced budget down the road a ways? With the common sense that the people have already shown, I'm sure we all know what the answer to that question would be. A gigantic tax increase has been built into the system. We propose nothing more than a reduction of that increase. The people have a right to know that even with our plan, they will be paying more in taxes, but not as much more as they will without it. The option, I believe, offered by the House Budget Committee will leave spending too high and tax rates too high. At the same time, I think it cuts the defense budget too much. And by attempting to reduce the deficit through higher taxes, it will not create the kind of strong economic growth and the new jobs that we must have. Let us not overlook the fact that the small independent businessman or woman creates more than 80% of all the new jobs and employs more than half of our total workforce. Our across-the-board cut in tax rates for a three-year period will give them much of the incentive and promise of stability they need to go forward with expansion plans calling for additional employees. Tonight, I renew my call for us to work as a team, to join in cooperation so that we find answers which will begin to solve all our economic problems and not just some of them. The economic recovery package that I've outlined to you over the past few weeks is, I deeply believe, the only answer that we have left. Reducing the growth of spending, cutting marginal tax rates, providing relief from overregulation, and following a non-inflationary and predictable monetary policy are interwoven measures which will ensure that we have addressed each of the severe dislocations which threaten our economic future. These policies will make our economy stronger, and the stronger economy will balance the budget, which we're committed to do by 1984. When I took the oath of office, I pledged loyalty to only one special interest group. We, the people. Those people, neighbors and friends, shopkeepers and laborers, farmers and craftsmen, do not have infinite patience. As a matter of fact, some 80 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt wrote these instructive words in his first message to the Congress. The American people are slow to wrath, but when their wrath is once kindled, it burns like a consuming flame. Well, perhaps that kind of wrath will be deserved if our answer to these serious problems is to repeat the mistakes of the past. The old and comfortable way is to shave a little here and add a little there. Well, that's not acceptable anymore. I think this great and historic Congress knows that way is no longer acceptable. I think you've shown that you know the one sure way to continue the inflationary spiral is to fall back into the predictable patterns of old economic practices. Isn't it time that we tried something new? When you allowed me to speak to you here in these chambers a little earlier, I told you that I wanted this program for economic recovery to be ours, yours and mine. I think the bipartisan substitute bill has achieved that purpose. It moves us toward economic vitality. Just 2 weeks ago, you and I joined millions of our fellow Americans in marveling at the magic historical moment that John Young and Bob Crippen created in their space shuttle Columbia. The last manned effort was almost 6 years ago, and I remembered on this more recent day over the years how we'd all come to expect technological precision of our men and machines. And each amazing achievement became commonplace until the next new challenge was raised. With a space shuttle, we tested our ingenuity once again, moving beyond the accomplishments of the past into the promise and uncertainty of the future. Thus, we not only planned to send up a 122-foot aircraft 170 miles into space, but we also intended to make it maneuverable and return it to Earth, landing 98 tons of exotic metals delicately on a remote dry lake bed. The space shuttle did more than prove our technological abilities. It raised our expectations once more. It started us dreaming again. The poet Carl Sandburg wrote, "The Republic is a dream. Nothing happens unless first a dream." And that's what makes us as Americans different. We've always reached for a new spirit and aimed at a higher goal. We've been courageous and determined, unafraid and bold. Who among us wants to be first to say we no longer have those qualities? That we must limp along, doing the same things that have brought us our present misery. I believe that the people you and I represent are ready to chart a new course. They look to us to meet the great challenge, to reach beyond the commonplace and not fall short for lack of creativity or courage. Someone you know has said that he who would have nothing to do with thorns must never attempt to gather flowers. But we have much greatness before us. We can restore our economic strength and build opportunities like none we've ever had before. As Carl Sandburg said, all we need to begin with is a dream that we can do better than before. All we need to have is faith, and that dream will come true. All we need to do is act, and the time for action is now. Thank you.
More from President Reagan's address after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
In January of 1985, just after his reelection, he took to the radio airwaves to deliver a radio address to the nation to talk about the strides the nation had made in the past 4 years, but how much further it still had to go. Let's listen.
My fellow Americans, hello again. This is my first radio talk since last November's election, and I'm glad to be back. There was some question if this show would be continued, but I guess the ratings were pretty good, so they took up my option. As you know, it was so cold here in Washington this week, we had to hold the inaugural ceremonies inside. That was a great disappointment to many who planned to attend, but I'm sure it was a good idea. An outside event would have given new meaning to our planned freeze on the federal government. The inauguration ceremony is simple and unpretentious, but sitting there next to Nancy waiting to take the oath of office, I was deeply stirred. In that short ceremony, our nation comes together to reaffirm our faith in individual liberty and celebrate the democratic institutions that have preserved and protected our freedom for over 200 years. To place one's hand in the Bible and solemnly swear to defend the Constitution of the United States is to be reminded of how strong the will of our free people, guided by faith, can be. Not only has our nation withstood and triumphed over the trials of history, the principles and values embodied in our Constitution have inspired the spread of democracy throughout the world. From times of hardship, we've always emerged with a renewed sense of confidence and a determination to meet and to conquer whatever challenges lie ahead. We start out the new year with good news. The fundamental strength and vitality of our economy is unquestionable. In 1984, we grew stronger and faster than we have in over 30 years, while inflation stayed lower than any time since 1967. Last month, 340,000 people found new jobs in an economy that now employs more people than ever before in history. Like a sapling in springtime, our economy sprang back after a long winter and reached for the sun. Once we began to remove the crushing weight of high taxes and overregulation, nothing could hold us back. Our challenges in 1985 is to build on the momentum of progress, to carry the economic expansion forward so that its opportunities and benefits touch every American. Let's make 1985 the year of opportunity. Let's use our economy, America's tremendous engine of prosperity, to break down the barriers and obstacles on the road to achievement. Our goal must be an open society in which hope is nourished and effort rewarded, where the promise of tomorrow is found in opportunity today. The entrepreneurial genius of the American people transformed a continent covered by wilderness into the leading industrial power in the world today. We in government should learn to look at our country with the eyes of the entrepreneur, seeing possibilities where others see only problems. That way, instead of the unemployed, we'd see a resource of potential workers waiting to add their labors, their ingenuity, their creativity to an expanding marketplace. And instead of ghettos, we'd see potential enterprise zones where increased incentives to work and invest could produce a renaissance of business activity and community involvement. It's my great hope that in the months ahead, forward-looking members from both sides of the aisle in the Congress will join with us in this important work. We must follow through on the policies that have given us 25 months of economic growth by simplifying our cumbersome tax codes and lowering rates still further, while making sure that the overall burden of government on our private economy grows no bigger. After we've come so far, we must never turn back to the old destructive habits of taxing and spending. With a future beckoning so brightly, we must move forward on the optimistic path of economic growth and expanding opportunity. Don't let anyone underestimate America. I'm reminded of a remark attributed to Thomas Watson, the chairman of the board of IBM back in 1943, to the effect that there was a world market for about five computers. Well, today, of course, there are millions of computers in homes and businesses, schools and hospitals across the country and around the world. But even an expert in the field couldn't predict the explosive growth of technology that we've seen recently. That's why we shouldn't hesitate to dream big. We must ask of ourselves only the best. We must challenge ourselves to hurdle the accepted limits of the past, to draw a new map of possibilities, and give new meaning to the word success. Isn't that, after all, what it means to be Americans? Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Was President Reagan successful in his efforts to turn the American economy around? Well, let's let the numbers tell the story. Over the 8 years of the Reagan administration, 20 million new jobs were created. Inflation dropped from 13.5% in 1980 to 4.1% by 1988. Unemployment fell from 7.6% to 5.5%. Net worth of families earning between $20,000 and $50,000 annually grew by 27%. And real gross product rose 26%. President Reagan once said, "I could tell our economic program was working when they stopped calling it Reaganomics." But what really pleased him most about the Reagan recovery was not the vindication or all the impressive statistics. To him, the success of Reaganomics was what brought it to the American people. Millions had good jobs and were able to keep more of the money for which they worked so hard. Families could reliably plan a budget and pay their bills. The seemingly insatiable federal government was on a much-needed diet. And businesses and individual entrepreneurs were no longer hassled by their government or paralyzed by burdensome and unnecessary regulations every time they wanted to expand. In a phrase, the American dream had been restored. Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Words to Live By podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores, and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of Words to Live By come out every Tuesday Like what you hear? Check out our A Reagan Forum podcast, featuring great speeches delivered at the Reagan Library. New episodes drop every Thursday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan 40 on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.